So let's take some time to get away from D.C. and everything else crazy in our world. And let's talk about other worlds and exoplanets, as they're called. Our friend Jason Steffen, who's now at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, works with the Kepler Institute. He used to work at Fermilab out here, but he's kind enough to still come on the phone with us once in a while. Hey, Jason, how are you this morning?
We're doing well. How are you?
Doing good, man. Haven't talked to you in a while. How's life in Nevada?
It's a little toasty.
Yeah, it is, isn't it?
Doing well.
What's the high temperature been recently?
We had a cold spell. It was only around 105 the last couple of days. But
did you put a shawl on during that time?
Yeah, I had to wear longer sleeves. But usually it's we had a couple of weeks where it was basically stayed at 115 for the whole time.
115. Now, we always hear, well, it's a dry heat. Are you like, yeah, you know what? For 115, this isn't as bad as I would think? Or is it like, oh, my God, this is pure misery?
115 does present some challenges. It rained a couple of days ago, and so then it gets humid, and then you might as well be, you know, in New York or someplace miserable. But if it's just over 100, it's not so bad.
Yeah.
Like between 100 and up to about 105, but then the screws get tightened, and it starts to get kind of uncomfortable.
I would imagine. All right, so let's chat with you. You're a good diversion from the rest of our world sometimes, Jason, and the work that you're doing to find exoplanets. And one of the most recent stories I'm reading about Kepler, because Kepler is winding down, right?
Yeah, so the final data release paper, I just got notification that it's ready to be submitted, and that will be kind of basically the mission closeout. The spacecraft itself is still functioning. It's been repurposed into the K2 mission. Because the way missions work with NASA is a mission is a combination of a spacecraft and a science program. And so the spacecraft, it's kind of limping along. And so they pointed it in a part of the sky that allows them, it's easier for them to steer it.
Okay.
And so it's still operating in a different kind of pointing in a different direction. And they've repurposed the science agenda somewhat
to better tailor
the K2 mission, but it's the same spacecraft.
So they're adding it so that the new mission is tailored to how to best use the craft as it's maybe getting older and not as agile anymore, whatever they have to. You said pointed in an area of the sky where they can steer it a little better. So now they're figuring out, okay, what's the best science we can find out of what we can still use this for?
Yeah, exactly.
Basically. And did the ship itself make it as long as it was supposed to? A lot of times the Mars rovers kept going on for years after they, you know, had planned for, and so that was a great bonus. Has the Kepler lasted as long as they were hoping?
It lasted 4 months beyond the requirement.
So that's good. That's, you know, not so, like, wow, 10 years longer, but that's still pretty cool.
It wasn't, I mean, there's only so much to complain about, but it was, it had enough. So there's two different steering mechanisms. One of them is what are called reaction wheels, so the gyros. And that's those things are very smooth, and they allow you to point very precisely. And the other mechanism is gas thrusters, hydrazine thrusters. And so that's the thing that squirts gas to steer the spacecraft.
Okay.
So there was enough hydrazine to do course pointing for, like, a decade. The reaction wheels are the things that failed. There were four, so there were three plus a backup, and then two of them failed.
Yeah. So they can only sort of steer it now.
Yeah, so what they did is it's actually kind of clever, the way they repurposed it, is they now look directly away from the sun, or almost directly away from the sun,
mm-hmm.
and they use the fact that when the spacecraft is pointed slightly in the wrong direction, that the light from the sun reflecting off the spacecraft pushes it back kind of into line. So NASA engineers are pretty smart people.
Well, they're very MacGyver-like. They have a history of trying to figure out, you know, what can we do in the situation, figuring out a workaround, don't they?
Yeah, they're like, yeah, hey, we got a Snickers bar and some duct tape. can we make this thing work?
We can get 10 more years out of this. How many more years are they hoping to get for the K2 mission then?
So the K2 mission, undergoes a fairly, it's a standard process. It's called the senior review, where it gets revisited every 2 years to see, basically every 2 years, there's a proposal submitted to extend the mission. And I say, this is what we'll do in the extended mission. This is what we've done with the time that you've given us so far.
And this is why it's worthwhile. Let's invest the funds and we can still get this much out of it. So they'll keep going as long as the science is producing something that makes it worthwhile to keep throwing some money at it, basically, right?
Right. And then eventually, you know, new missions, the budget just constraints say it's time to do a new mission and then it
goes away.
Yeah.
And the K2 mission, is it still taking pictures of exoplanets? Is it still searching for exoplanets?
Yeah, it's still primarily an exoplanet mission. But they also, so some of the things that they've done is to look for exoplanets in different parts of the galaxy, and in different, around different kinds of stars. So those are where it was looking before. It was looking primarily for exoplanets around stars that are a lot like the sun, mm-hmm. and they tended to be isolated stars. There is quite a bit of work that's being done now on looking for planets orbiting in clusters of stars. Typically when stars form, they'll form in groups. And in some cases, the groups are very dense. There'll be like, you know, 100,000 or so stars that are all right next to each other. And so,
and when you say right next to each other, Jason,
just down the street.
how right so next to each other are we
right
talking?
Next to each other, they're pretty close. I mean, it would be within, I guess I don't know the typical size. Okay, I can figure this out.
Within, so, like, yeah, how many light years of each other are we thinking?
Like less than one.
Less than one? Stars within less than one light year from each other?
Yeah.
So that's insanely close in cosmic terms, right?
Yeah, by galactic standards, that's right next to each other. I mean, that's well within, like, the solar system is basically a light year across. So you'd have several stars within the solar system.
Wow. So if that was our solar system, if we had several stars within our solar system, would our planet still be habitable?
Ours would be. Now, when I say the solar system, I mean the broader solar system. So it's not just
our nine planets.
This is like going way out there.
But we'd have some really bright stuff in the sky at night if we had seven planets or seven stars within even our extended solar system, wouldn't we?
Yeah, and they would move in a way that would be not necessarily obvious to an individual person in their lifetime, but, you know, 1,000 years is a long time, and you'd be able to see the stars changing positions over that amount of time. So the Greeks would have a totally different sky of the brightest stars in that situation.
Yeah. Would there ever be, so when you find these, so now you're looking at planets at clusters, but it is still possible for planets to be habitable even if stars are only a light year away from each other?
Yeah, because that doesn't, they wouldn't add a whole lot of light. You might run into issues where there are, when you have stars that are that close, that it disrupts some of the more distant comets. Mm-hmm. And so it might be a bit more of a hazardous place to live in that you would have comets that are disrupted more regularly and therefore have the potential to have dinosaur killing impacts more frequently.
If we had, so if you found planets that were habitable within one light year of other stars, I mean, that's the real, because right now, if we found life somewhere else in our universe, we wouldn't, I mean, maybe we could contact through radio waves, things like that, but travel is seemingly impossible, at least at the current state of technology, right? But if there was a, if you guys found a cluster of stars only light year apart and habitable planets by several of them, that would lead to a possibility of not only maybe there is other life out there, but if there's if there is intelligent life, they could actually be with having real contact with each other too, couldn't they?
Yeah, if life was really common and that most stars had a habitable planet around them, then you could easily imagine a scenario where you have habitable planets. Now, developing intelligent life, a lot of the issue is how long does intelligent life last on a planet? And in this case, when I say intelligent life, I mean life that's sufficiently intelligent to communicate with other planets. How long of a window do you have? Because if for example, it only, and I guess we'll find out, you know, if intelligent life that can communicate with other systems only lasts for about a century, then you have a 1 century window out of 5 billion year lifetime of the system, at least to this so far in our own solar system.
Well, I don't like where this is going, Jason. Is that really the thought that there might be only a century of? So you're not saying, hey, we already beat that. We've been here for, you know, thousands of years. You're saying to the point where civilization gets technologically advanced enough that they could communicate with another system, they might only have 100 years. That would mean that we've only got about 50 years left, and then you guys are worried that we're kaput?
Oh, no, that's not a prediction, right?
Okay.
That's just, we don't know how long civilizations that afford those kinds of comforts to their citizens before the citizens become unruly and decide that it was better when we were chasing bunnies with sticks.
Are you really thinking that, or are you thinking that either global warming makes it, or some sort of climate change makes a planet uninhabitable, or meteor strike, or something, you know, dinosaur type impact? You're not thinking that generally after a couple thousand years, the inhabitants of a planet just can't stand each other anymore and they completely destroy it. I hope you're not saying that, right?
It is more of, can a civilization that gets that advanced, okay, you can't really prevent asteroid impacts, right? Those are going to be things that happen. You can, I guess, at our point, if we were to see far enough in advance, we could probably do something about an asteroid, and it would not likely involve sending oil drillers to the planet with a nuclear, or to the asteroid with a nuclear weapon to drill down. And
can we at least send Ben Affleck?
If he wants to go.
What if we all want him to go?
We could debate. We have to put that to a vote, right?
We can figure that out another time. We've got time on that one. But you're saying that there, you do think that if we, how far away would we have to spot an asteroid that was going to affect Earth significantly enough that we want to do something about it? How many years heads up would we need current state of technology to figure it out? If they said, okay, there's a meteor coming in 3 weeks and it is going to wipe out the planet unless we do something about it. Do you think the world would be able to come together and figure out a way to?
I would be dead. There's no
chance.
Yeah,
that would be the worst possible thing ever. We would so be better off not knowing, don't you think? If they announced to the world, hey, here's the thing: it's about 6 miles wide. It's going to hit at this place. It will completely destroy everything in the world. We're all going to die. But you got about 3.5 weeks till it happens. I think that's the worst possible thing we could ever hear, because I think the world probably wouldn't last the 3.5 weeks.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, I guess in that regard is that at this point, most of the close encounters we have with asteroids, and when I say close encounters, I mean, these things are way the heck out there. They're not,
right?
Like, having an actual close encounter is, it's close in some relative term. It's not actually close compared to the size of the atmosphere, for example.
Mm-hmm.
We usually find them after they've already gone by. But there are... surveys that are planned. The one that's coming up, and it should be relatively soon. I haven't been keeping close track of it. It's called the Large Synoptic Survey Telescope, LSST.
Mm-hmm.
And this telescope is going to get like a bazillion bytes of data. It's like a petabyte of data a night. It's going to basically image the whole sky every 3 days. And it can see dim enough to find the asteroids that right now are the spookiest ones.
Mm.
Because the biggest ones we know about already. They're bright enough that we have already seen them. And so we're not too worried about the big ones because we know where they are and we can keep an eye on them. And their orbital changes are slight. I mean, we're talking like tens of thousands of years for some of these things to make much impression on their orbits. So it takes a long time. We know where they're going to be tens of thousands of years from now, let me put it that way.
How much time would we need Well, I'll tell you what. You think about this. I got to take a break before we get to the news. Why don't you answer this when we come back? How much time would we need? What kind of heads up would we have to alter a course or change or blow up or whatever we're going to do to an asteroid? Think about that. We'll be right back. Matt Bubala with you on 720 WGN. Matt Bubala with you, 720 WGN. We're chatting with our buddy Jason Steffen from the Kepler Institute and University of Nevada at Las Vegas. What's your official title there, Jason? What's your title at UNLV?
I'm an assistant professor.
Are you going to be a full professor at some point instead of an assistant?
One of these days. One of these days. That's the plan.
That is the plan.
It's not an institute. It's just a regular department.
He's out in my stomping grounds out there. That's my old second home,
that's
Vegas.
Right. Lived
there 3.5 years.
What was the radio
years?
Station you worked at there, Raj?
Oh, gosh. KDWN.
You, say, you can't KFMS,
remember? KBMI.
All the K's. You worked at all the K's.
Well, there are a lot of K's out there. Yeah.
All right, so we got a break for the news in a second. But, Jason, before that, so tell me, how much lead time would we need if there was a meteor coming that was going to end life as we know it and everybody had to band together, all the powers to stop it? How much lead time would they need?
I have a great answer for you. And that answer is it depends. So it depends on how massive the object is, but I think you would probably want something like thousands of orbits of that object.
Meaning it would pass by Earth thousands of times before it was going to hit us?
Yeah. So, because what that does is it allows you, and we can do this, right? We can measure the position of something and see how long it's going to take. Like, it's not going to hit us next week. It's
right.
This will come close to us 1,000 years from now or something like that.
Oh, my God. We would need 1,000 years leeway? You said that most of these things we find about after they passed.
Well, but that was then. Now, the new now is going to be that with this new telescope that's going up, we'll be able to see the things that are the ones that are most dangerous. They're the ones that come by more frequently and that are large enough to cause significant destruction.
If we only had a year, say we only had a year, with the nuclear weapons we have, we couldn't figure out how to shoot one into space?
Nuclear weapons I don't think are the thing. If people can get creative, right? So you have to really, I think you would have to think very hard about how to deflect an asteroid. Whoops, sorry. How to deflect an asteroid in only a year. I'm not saying it couldn't be done, but it would take a lot of creativity. If you had 1,000 years, which is a reasonable, 1,000 years is a totally reasonable amount of time when you're talking about like predicting the position of something in the sky that you know its orbit. Then you can do something that's actually fairly boring, like paint it white or something like that, so that the radiation pressure from the sun actually deflects it in its orbit, and then it would miss the Earth.
You're right. That is a boring way to do it. Americans like to blow stuff up, I think, and we need to get rid of these nuclear weapons anyway so we don't all kill each other. So let's just go blow something. You know that people would totally, if it was put for a vote, Jason, and they said, well, we could just paint it white, and then the radiation of the sun will move it itself, or we could blow that thing up. We're all going to vote to blow it up, right?
Certainly, depending on the time of the year, right?
Yes, you'd be very patriotic.
July, exactly. Like, look out in the distance, you'll see this, you know. The thing is that these things, they're big, right? These are big objects. The ones that we're worried about are big. We're not really worried about the small stuff.
And how big are we talking?
That lands on
like
Earth
2 mile
time,
in
right?
diameter or what? How big is big, like Earth-ending big? Doesn't have to be that crazy huge, right?
I'd have to look that one up. If you had something that was like a kilometer in diameter or something like that, it's probably...
Okay. So wouldn't one nuclear weapon exploding inside alter its trajectory enough to probably throw it off course?
No, not really.
Really?
You have a kilometer of rock. That's like a mountain, right? You have this mountain-sized thing going through space.
Yeah.
Instead of a nuclear bomb, it'll be like, it'd be like a fly hitting it.
Wait a minute. If you threw a nuclear bomb, if we had one of our missiles that's pointed at Russia right now, and we shot it at Mount Everest, wouldn't that severely change the look of Mount Everest? I would think enough that if it was floating through the sky, it would move it a little bit, no?
Move it a little bit, but it would it move it enough? You know, the two nuclear bombs that have been dropped, and they were small by modern standards. You know, it's not like it changed. It devastated the city, but those are all man-made structures, right? When you have like a mountain, that's a different animal.
Wow, that's fascinating. Okay, we're going to take a quick break for the news. When we come back, I want to ask you about some of the stuff that's been in the news lately. I want to ask you more, of course, about Kepler, but also Anonymous said recently that they think NASA is going to reveal that they found life. I want to ask you about that. We've got a big solar eclipse coming across America in August. And also, you said something interesting earlier. You said if life was really common, when I asked you about if, you know, these habitable planets could talk to each other, you said if life was really common, I want to ask you about that. And is it still possible for us ever to say life is common out there? Or because we're having such trouble finding life out there, does that mean that life is not common at all? We'll find out after the news. Matt Bubala with you. It is raining pretty good again on Michigan Avenue, Roger. As you said, we had a little break there for a little bit, but it's coming down again, and it's coming down heavy. 312-981-7200 is the number. We're chatting with our old friend Jason Steffen from the Kepler mission. He's an assistant professor out at UNLV. Jason, thanks for staying up later with us. We appreciate you still coming on the phone with us, even though you live so far away now, and it's... Well, I guess it's better for you now than it used to be here when you lived in Chicago, and it'd be 3:40 in the morning instead of 1:40 in the morning. But thank you.
Yeah, it's, this is, you know, about the time I go to bed anyway. So
is it really? Are you a bit of a night owl?
I do my best work after the kids go to bed.
That makes sense. I totally understand that. Hey, and I've asked you this, but it's been a long time since I've asked you. Since you've moved out to Nevada, and you're only less probably than an hour away from some really dark nighttime skies, have you ever gotten out into the desert and really looked up at all the stuff you're studying so often in your office?
Not recently. just because most of my we'll have a chance with like some scout camps and stuff like that. We went camping a couple months ago. And it had been a while since I'd seen that much of the sky, because Las Vegas is kind of an anomaly in terms of the amount of light that it produces.
Yeah. Interesting. Okay. All right. So a couple of things. First of all, earlier you said, when I was asking you about these planets and if they're close together, you said, well, if life was really common, do you think we'll ever say life is really common? Or do you think we've been searching for long enough now that we're going to say we might find life elsewhere, but it's not ever going to be considered common throughout the universe?
I guess common is a relative term. You have to define it in terms of something, like what fraction of stars have life around them. Mm-hmm. And if there's 300 billion stars in our galaxy and it happens that there's only one out of every billion stars that that has life around it, that's still 300 in a single galaxy, which isn't necessarily a small number.
But we know that there are billions.
I think we've only just barely begun to scratch the surface of this.
So
I mean, we're really at the rudimentary stage of doing this kind of stuff.
So and that was talking about just within our galaxy, and we know that there are billions of galaxies, right?
Yeah. So there are, if you add up all the stars in the visible universe, you get about 10 stars for every grain of sand on the Earth.
Think about that next time you're walking along the beach. Yikes.
There's a lot of stars out there. And so life, I don't know. I'm personally not going to be surprised if we find that there's life out there.
It would be stunning if we didn't at some point, right? To think that there are billions of galaxies, that there are more stars than grains of sand. You said 10 stars for every grain of sand?
Yeah.
Which means that there are possibly, 100 planets for every grain of sand? Something like that, right?
Something like that.
Possibly.
Around there.
So to think that we would be the only thing ever in that vast openness would be stunning. It would be surprising.
I guess it depends on who you ask. I think that... this is my personal opinion. There's no science behind this statement, but I just think not going to be surprised when we find signatures of life on another planet.
Well, when I've talked to you in the past, I've tried to make you promise me that before I die, we will have this figured out. And you wouldn't promise me that. Have you changed your thinking at all? Will we? I'll give you 50 years. I'm going to try to hold out 50 more years. By the time I die, will you be able to say to me, we'll be in the old age home together, just rotting there, and you'll say, you know what, Matt, we did it. We found it. And I told you we would.
I will promise you that I will not say that when we're in the old folks home together. So
will you...
I don't know how long it will take to do it, because there's a lot of, I guess there's a lot of stuff that needs to get shaken out in terms of scientifically about what a biosignature actually looks like. And I mean, and there are people working on this. It's not that there aren't people looking at it. It's that there's a lot of unknown unknowns that we need to find out and kind of sort through.
Oh, you went all Rumsfeld on me there for a second. There's a lot of unknown unknowns. Well, I believe that. I believe there's a lot. How do you think, if you had a guess, if you just were throwing a, making a bet somewhere, how we're going to find out at first that there is some sort of life elsewhere? Will it just be we're going to figure out? I mean, we've sort of already figured out that there has been life on Mars and stuff like that, right? Haven't we found microbes and things like that where we know that life has not only always existed on Earth?
I don't know that there's been a smoking gun on Mars. There's definitely been, we definitely know that there's water on Mars and that there has been water, like flowing water on Mars.
Mm-hmm.
But we really, you know, how much of Mars have we actually explored in a reasonable detail? Like nothing, basically. So we've mapped the surface, but we've only mapped the surface, you know, in terms of like digging in the dirt and pulling stuff out and analyzing it.
You know, we haven't done enough of that yet.
Yeah, we've had like one car driving around at 1 meter per second for the last decade, so...
So we don't know enough. Okay, Anonymous, yeah. The crazy hackers Anonymous that wear the Guy Fawkes masks. Somebody posted a video a couple of weeks ago, maybe a month ago now, saying that NASA is about to announce that they know of alien life, or that they have some proof of alien life, whatever, whatever. NASA has not done that since this was posted. Do you think there's any chance that there is knowledge, that the government has knowledge, that there is some sort of hidden knowledge of alien life? I mean, would the government keep throwing all this money at you guys and things like that if they secretly had knowledge of alien life? Or do you think there's no way? Nothing happened in Roswell. There's none of that. People aren't actually going up and getting anal probed. There's no cows being abducted. Do you think all of that is hubbly?
I don't think that there's any evidence that anyone has that there's life or that aliens have come to this planet. And the amount of money that it would take, I just don't see this as being even remotely close to reality.
It seems crazy that an advanced alien civilization would travel as far as we know that they would have to travel, which is insanely far, even if they're incredibly advanced. Still very impressive if they got here. It'd be very unlikely, right, that they would come all this way and then just... you know, pluck somebody off a farm in the middle of the night and prod them and then return them. That seems...
Yeah,
us not to notice ever,
I mean,
with all the...
These kinds of things, they're like not even wrong, right? It's so far out there that it does not... It's an indication that the proponents of this don't understand the sizes of numbers that are involved in the universe. The distances that are involved.
And would it be possible if ships were coming from other planets, if say this was happening, middle of the night, whatever, people being abducted, with everything we have in the sky. Now I know that like you just said that, hey, sometimes meteors pass by and we don't see them till after they're gone. If it was possible for flying saucers, things like this to get here, do this. And for whatever crazy reason, they thought, yeah, we made it all this way. Let's just check out somebody on a road somewhere, put them back and freak them out a little bit. Would they be able to do that without some satellite, something picking up the fact that there were UFOs in the sky?
kind of unlikely. You know, I guess it depends on what amazing propulsion systems very advanced civilizations have, but you know, they still have the same laws of physics that we do. It's not like they get. It's not like when you get advanced civilization status that you can be like, oh, let's write some new laws of physics and change how the universe works in my little compartment. I mean, the amount of toilet paper that they would have to have on their ship just to get here is so big that.
Well, is there a possibility that they figured out wormholes or other things like that, and they don't have to just, you know, take 100,000 light years to travel here, that they could actually figure out some way that with the way the universe bends and this and that, they were able to transport themselves here more quickly? Or do you think that that's, even with their incredibly advanced knowledge, that ain't happening?
It makes great science fiction, you know, good opportunities for people to do, like, scientific art, but that's not a thing.
Okay, well, let's talk about this, because I would have never thought this was a thing, but we were just reading the story last week that, so they're looking into teleportation, right? There's research into teleportation. Supposedly China has created photons, and they have some satellite in the sky, and they sent a photon to the satellite in the sky and kept one here on Earth, and they're saying that they have, in very small little increments, been able to achieve teleportation. Am I completely misunderstanding what that even means?
So it's teleportation. So this is a real thing, but teleportation in a very technical and strict sense. And that is that they have been able to send quantum information over some great distance that basically faster than you would be able to communicate between those two objects. That's basically what it says. So it's not, I mean, it's not like they took a baseball or an apple and teleported it somewhere. What they did is you take a single quantum particle, a photon, and you split it into two photons that are entangled, meaning that you split into two photons in such a way that the quantum numbers, things like the spin, the polarization, the polarization of the photons, the angular momentum of the photons, some of these different pieces of quantum information gets shared between the daughter particles. You take an incoming photon, you break it into two photons that are lower energy, but they share quantum particle or quantum information. Then you separate the two daughter particles some great distance, and then you measure the properties of one of the particles, and that tells you what the properties of the other particle are. But you can't actually know the properties until you measure them. One thing with quantum particles is that you can't actually know what property something has until you make the measurement. And so in that regard, you can instantly know the quantum properties of the distant particle based upon what you learn about the one that you have in your laboratory.
And if you mess with the one in the, from what I understand, tell me if I'm completely wrong on this, once you have those separated like that, if you mess with the one in the laboratory, it's going to mess in the same way with the one that is a distance away?
Yeah, basically, yeah. This is something, there's a colleague that I have in my department who actually works on quantum computing and quantum encryption and entangled states and stuff like that. But it being summertime, we've not crossed paths since this result has come out. Mm-hmm. And so it is something that I intend to corner him in a few weeks once school kind of gets back into session.
And find out what in the world does that mean. Okay. Well, then that will
Just so I understand, like, what really are they talking about? I mean, I could read the paper, but that sounds like work. I could just go, you know, knock on his door and have him do all the work.
It's good to know that even rocket scientists like you or guys are like, yeah, I'm not gonna read that paper. Joe can tell me what that means. I'll let him do it.
I certainly read some of the articles, and I got the idea. Okay, the quantum teleportation, it's about entangled states, to gain the kind of insight that I would like to have when I discuss it with people, would require more than just reading a single paper.
Yeah. And so the crazy thing, though, is because we think of Star Trek and teleporting and stuff, this really is nowhere near anything like that. They're talking about what this could really help with is better Wi-Fi, right? That's when what I read, they're like, oh, this might really help our Wi-Fi someday. I don't understand that, but that's what I read.
Yeah, okay, so that might take a little time for me to figure that one out, too. What it can do, in terms of Wi-Fi, for example, it can make it so that you don't need to do handshaking as much. Like, yeah, did you get the packet? Yes, I got the packet. Thank you. Send the next one. Okay, I got this packet, too. That when you have quantum information, the information is absolutely preserved. Like, you measure one particle, and that tells you exactly what the other particle is doing. And so if you can get that to where your measurements are accurate enough, then you basically have no data loss in these kinds of systems.
And that would somehow make these things insanely fast.
It'd make it fast. And this is straying well outside of my expertise.
Sure.
But, you know, the kinds of things you can do with this type of capability, I think, are kind of unknown. I mean, this is a realm. My suspicion is that it has the potential to be as revolutionary as the transistor was. And the transistor is what took us from, took us into the digital age, basically.
Yeah. And enabled everything that you're doing today, really, right?
Yeah, I mean, I have my laptop open because I looked up the near Earth asteroid thing. There's an ongoing survey now called Pan-STARRS that looks exactly at the asteroid threat, commissioned by Congress, where they said, you know, look for these things and we want this kind of completeness and stuff like that. So if your listeners want to look it up and see kind of what's been done, and it actually has one of these, how do you steer an asteroid away from the Earth if it's coming towards us? But the asteroid threat, Pan-STARRS is the name of the survey.
Pan-STARRS. Hey, real quick, I got to let you...
And this computer would not be able to work if it weren't for the transistor.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, so I got to let you go in a second because we got to do news. But there's going to be this crazy eclipse that we're, you know, isn't going to be over America again for like 100 years. Are you going to get out and see any of that?
Well, I just found out that my UNLV classes actually start a week later than I thought they were. I thought that my first day of school for teaching was going to be the day of the eclipse. But it's actually a week after that. And so there's a possibility that I will be able to visit my sister's home, which is in Idaho, right underneath the complete shadow. If not, then, you know, there's going to be plenty of people live streaming. And in fact, UNLV is flying a balloon. There's a bunch of universities that are making balloon payloads to watch the thing go overhead.
No, that's
kind of do a live stream all along the trajectory. I may be able to go. I haven't passed it with my better half yet. I haven't talked with her about it. But I do have, I'm sure I could bother my sister for a couch for an evening.
Yeah, I think that sounds really cool. So it's like August 21st, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's going to one of the really, I thought I read one of the best places is going to be down just south of Peoria here in Illinois, I think, is going to be one of the really good places to watch, or something like that. Not too far.
Yeah, it goes
like,
right within across.
Driving distance.
I mean, this is like heartland USA. I mean, it goes from the Pacific Northwest to the Mid-Atlantic states, right through the middle of farm country. I mean, Wyoming is going to get a huge swath, and I'm not sure about Iowa. I'd have to look up the map, but
it's so better not be a cloudy day.
It does go right through the Midwest. Yeah. It goes through places where Portillo's is a thing.
Are you missing some Portillo's, Jason? Is that one of the big regrets?
Absolutely, I'm missing Portillo's. I miss it almost every day. There is one that's in Riverside that's only 3 hours away, but I've not had the chance to go there.
Only 3 hours away.
We do have Culver's here, though.
Oh,
we do have Culver's in Utah. There are three of them.
Well, and you have In-N-Out Burger in Vegas, and you don't have that here in Chicago, and people often kind of compare and contrast Culver's and In-N-Out. What's your theory on In-N-Out?
I would would rather go to Culver's.
Okay. That's fair enough. Fair enough. It's not
because
fair.
Because one scoop turtle at Culver's is...
Oh, you're talking more about the ice cream than the burgers. Okay. All right. Fair enough. Jason Steffen from the Kepler Mission and UNLV. So awesome of you to jump on the phone with us. We'll talk again, maybe right after the solar eclipse. I'll get you a review of that. How about that?
Sounds good.
All right, Jason. Thanks so much for staying up, buddy. Have a great morning.
No problem. Bye.
Right. Talk to you soon. Jason Steffen from UNLV and the Kepler Mission.